It's all a result of perception. A man rapes because he sees no other way to satisfy an urgent, terrible need. Libby kills because she sees no other way to reach goals that are as vital to her as the very air she breathes, and were planted in her mind when she was too young to know what was taking place. She, like the rapist, is wrong, horrifically wrong. And it is our job, yours, mine, Sarah's, all of ours, to understand the perceptions that lead to such misbegotten actions, so that we may have some hope of keeping others from being enslaved by them. Reaching out to touch my knee, the doctor looked into my eyes with an expression what showed all the pain he'd felt when his beloved Mary Palmer had died just steps from where I was sitting. You have lost someone you cared for deeply to those wretched perceptions and to that enslavement. Can you now go on? We haven't much time. And if you wish to stay out of what's left to be done...
He was cut off by a pair of sounds, a clap of thunder from the sky above, then the ringing of the telephone beyond the kitchen. I couldn't and can't say exactly why, but for some reason the pairing of those noises reminded me that El Niño was still out and at work, and that I still hadn't heard anything from him. With that realization, I stopped crying for the moment and struggled to get to my feet. "I'd better answer that," I said, starting back toward the kitchen. "It might be El Niño. I left him to watch over the duster's place."
"Stevie..."
I stopped and turned to see the doctor still studying me, sympathetically but with real purpose.
"If you cannot go on, no one will blame you. But if you choose to go on, then remember what our work is."
I just nodded, then headed into and past the kitchen, picking up the receiver of the phone and pulling the mouthpiece down. "Yeah?" I said.
"Señorito Stevie."
It was El Niño, all right, his voice still very businesslike and determined.
"Do you have news of your friend?"
I sighed once, trying to hold back more tears. "The woman got to her," I said. "She's dead. Mr. Picton, too." El Niño muttered something softly in a language what I couldn't place, neither English nor Spanish. I figured it for the native tongue of his people.
"So..." he went on, after a moment's pause. "The need for justice has grown. I am sorry for that, Señorito Stevie."
"Where are you?" I asked.
"In the stables across from the house of the woman. She has returned there with baby Anna. I paid the man here for to use his telephone."
"And the dusters?"
"They are everywhere on the street."
"Don't make any play, then," I told him. "If you can see some of them, that means there's even more what you can't see. Stay out of sight."
"Yes. But if the chance comes, she dies, yes?"
Looking back into the kitchen, I saw that the doctor and Miss Howard had come into it. They were watching me as I talked, probably knowing full well who was on the other end of the line.
"I don't know about that," I said, looking to the doctor.
"But, Señorito Stevie, your friend has died."
"I know," I answered, "but it might be more complicated than we thought. We need to know why she's doing this."
The aborigine gave that a moment's thought and a sigh before answering.
"I tell you, Señorito Stevie, in jungles I have seen in my journeys there are villagers who live near the lairs and hunting grounds of tigers. Some of these tigers kill men, some do not. No one knows why. But all know that the tigers who do kill must die. For once they drink the blood of man, they never lose the taste for it."
I couldn't figure how to answer him. Half of me knew that what he was saying, terrible as it was, made very real sense.
"Señorito Stevie, you are there?"
"I'm here."
"Will you hunt the tiger with me, or will you try to understand it?"
I looked to the doctor again, knowing even in my sorrow what I had to do.
"I can't," I said, turning away so that the doctor and Miss Howard wouldn't hear me. "I can't do it with you, but you go on. And don't call here again. They'll try to stop you."
There was another pause. Then El Niño said,
"Yes, it is best, this. It is not for us to decide what is the way. Only the gods and fate can determine who will reach her first. I understand you, my friend.
Yeah, I whispered. I understand you too.
I hope I shall see you again. If I do not, remember that I still wear the clothes you gave me. And when I do, I see your face and feel your friendship. I am proud of this.
The words put me near to tears again. I've got to go, I said, replacing the receiver on its little hook before El Niño had a chance to say anything more.
The Aborigine?
The doctor asked. I nodded, moving into the kitchen.
He's down on Bethune Street. She's back there with Anna. But the neighborhood's crawling with dusters.
I see.
The doctor started pacing around the kitchen table.
Has she returned to the house simply to collect her things, or to rid herself of the burden of Anna Linares in the safety of her secret hideaway?
After pondering this for a few seconds, the doctor rapped a fist on the table.
In either case, we have run out of time. The crisis will play out tonight. If Marcus is successful, we can use the full power of the police department to enter the house. If not...
But even if he is, Miss Howard added, can we be sure she won't harm the child before we get there? Or while we're trying to get in?
We can be sure of nothing, the doctor answered. But we must try to attend to what we can. With that in mind, Sarah, I suggest that you call Senora Linares, advise her that we must now take action, and that its results may not please her husband. She may wish to seek safety in some place other than her own home.
Nodding in agreement, Miss Howard moved to the phone just as Cyrus entered the kitchen and put a strong, comforting hand to my shoulder.
Ah, Cyrus, the doctor went on, some of your excellent coffee is called for, I think. We won't be catching up on our sleep any time soon, and clear heads will be needed.
Yes, sir,
Cyrus answered. Then he looked down at me.
Might be enough time for you to get a little rest, Stevie. You could use it.
I just shook my head. I don't want to sleep, I said, remembering what had happened the last time I'd drifted off.
Make that coffee strong, though.
Always do, Cyrus said. Oh, and doctor, the detective sergeant asked me to tell you that he's gone down to headquarters to give his brother a hand. Says he's worried about how long it's taken.
As am I, the doctor answered, checking his watch. It would seem on the surface to be a fairly straightforward matter, like so many things about this case.
Not really feeling ready yet to talk about the particulars of what we were going to do next, I wandered on upstairs, where I found Mr. Moore in the parlor. He'd turned one of the doctor's easy chairs around to face a window what he'd opened, so as he could get a good view of the storm what was continuing to batter the city. Collapsing onto the nearby settee, I joined him in quietly studying the wind-tossed trees in Stuyvesant Park.
"Hell of a storm,"
I mumbled, looking over to see that Mr. Moore's face was full of the same kind of sadness and confusion that was eating away at my own soul.
"Hell of a summer," he answered. "But the weather's always crazy in this goddamn town."
He managed to turn to me for just a few quick seconds.
"I really am sorry, Stevie."
"Yeah," I answered. "Me too. I mean, about Mr. Picton." Mr. Moore nodded and let out a big gush of air, shaking his head.
"So now we're supposed to catch this woman," he mumbled. "Catch her and study her. It's not exactly what I'm in the mood for."
"No," I agreed. He held a finger up like he was lecturing the angry heavens.
"Rupert," he said, "never believed you could learn anything from killers after you'd caught them. He said it was like trying to study the hunting habits of wild animals by watching feeding time at a menagerie. He'd have been the first to say that we should kill this bitch if we get the chance."
"It might happen," I said with a shrug. "El Niño is still out there somewhere. And he won't stop to ask her why she does the things she does. All he'll want is a clear shot when she's not holding the baby."
"Well, I hope he gets one,"
Mr. Moore answered flatly. "Or for that matter, that I do." I looked at him again.
"You really think you could kill her?"
"Could you?"
he answered, going for a cigarette. I shrugged.
"I've been thinking about that."
Might as well be me as some electrician at Sing Sing, if she's going to die, but I don't know. Won't bring anybody back.
Mr. Moore hissed out smoke as he lit his stick. You know, he said, his face still looking sad, but irritated, too. I've always hated that expression.
For a few more minutes we sat quietly, starting every now and then when a big clap of thunder boomed, or a bolt of lightning shot down into what seemed like the heart of the city. Then the other three joined us, Cyrus carrying a coffee service and sending it down on the rolling cocktail cart. The doctor could read Mr. Moore's and my moods well enough not to start talking about any plans right away. So we all just drank the coffee and watched the storm for another half hour or so, until a hansom pulled up at the curb outside and produced the two detective sergeants. They'd pretty obviously been bickering inside the cab, and they kept right on going when they got into the house. Things, it seemed, had not gone well downtown. "It's cowardice," Marcus explained, after taking a careful moment to tell me how sorry he was about Cat. "Absolute cowardice. Oh, they'll get the warrant authorized, all right, but if apprehending the woman means going up against the dusters, they're not interested." "I've been trying to remind my brother," Lucius said, pouring himself a cup of coffee, "of what happened the last time the police department attempted a large-scale confrontation with the Hudson dusters. An embarrassing number of officers ended up in the hospital. Kids on the west side still taunt patrolmen by singing little ditties about it. And let's not forget who can generally be found hanging around the dusters' place," Miss Howard added. "A lot of well-connected people in this town like to go down there to take cocaine and romanticize about the lives of gangsters, the fools."
"That doesn't excuse cowardice," Marcus insisted, himself going for some of Cyrus's brew.
"Damn it, we're talking about one woman who is a mass murderer, for God's sake, and the department doesn't want to get involved because they're afraid they'll lose face."
"The department doesn't want to get involved," the doctor said, "because no one that they view as being of any importance has yet been killed. You know as well as I do that such has always been the rule in this city, Marcus. We had a brief respite under Roosevelt, but none of the reforms really took hold."
"Then what's our answer?" Lucius asked, looking around the room. I knew what I was thinking, and I knew that Mr. Moore and Marcus probably felt the same way. If nobody else was going to take care of the job, it was up to us to go down there, bust into that hell house on Bethune Street, and do what had to be done. But none of the three of us was going to give voice to this opinion while the doctor was in the room, knowing, as we did, that he placed such a high value on our taking Libby Hatch alive. Which was why his next line of thought came as kind of a surprise.
"The Navy," he said quietly, his black eyes lighting up.
"The what?" Mr. Moore responded, looking dumbfounded.
"The Navy," the doctor repeated, turning to Marcus. "Detective Sergeant, we know that the Hudson Dusters relish conflict with the New York City Police Department. How would they feel, do you suppose, about an encounter with the United States Navy?"
"Chrysler," Mr. Moore said, "you have obviously gone around some bend." Ignoring Mr. Moore, Marcus began to nod. "Offhand, I'd say they'd back off. Navy men are, as you know, pretty renowned brawlers, and they carry the authority of the federal government, not just the city. Political connections and local rivalries wouldn't get into the thing."
The doctor began to bounce the knuckles of his right hand against his mouth. "Yes," he said quietly. Then another thought seemed to flash in his head. "The White Star Line's pier is, I believe, just a few blocks around the corner from Libby Hatch's house on Bethune Street. Isn't that right?"
"Yes, it is," Miss Howard said, looking puzzled. "At 10th Street. Why, doctor?"
Seeing a copy of the morning edition of the Times tucked into Marcus's jacket pocket, the doctor stood up and snatched it away. Quickly ruffling its pages, he searched for what seemed like some small but important piece of information. "No White Star ships currently in port," he eventually said with a nod. "Then he could have a vessel land there, and we could approach the house from the rear, taking the gang by relative surprise."
"Who could?" Mr. Moore near shouted. "Laszlo, what in hell—" All of a sudden his jaw dropped as he got it. "Oh, no. Oh, no, Kreitzler, that is insane. You can't. Not Roosevelt."
"Yes," the doctor answered, looking up from the paper with a smile. "Roosevelt."
Mr. Moore scrambled to his feet.
"Get Theodore involved in this case? Once he finds out what's going on, he'll start his damned war against Spain right here in this city."
"Precisely why," the doctor replied. "He must not be told all the details. Ana Linares's name and lineage need not concern him. The fact that we are attempting to solve a string of murders and a kidnapping and can get no satisfaction from the New York police will be more than enough to rouse Theodore's interest."
"But," said Miss Howard, who, like Mr. Moore and the doctor, had known Mr. Roosevelt for most of her life, "what can even Theodore possibly do? He's Assistant Secretary of the Navy, yes, but—"
"And just now he's treating the entire fleet as if it were his own," the doctor replied, holding up an envelope. "A letter from him came during our absence. It seems that Secretary Long is on vacation for the month of August. And Theodore has been making bold moves. He's becoming known as the warm-weather secretary around Washington, a fact of which he is inordinately and typically proud. I'm certain there are one or two serviceable vessels and crews out at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, perhaps even closer. More than enough men to meet our purposes. An order from Roosevelt is all the thing would require."
Mr. Moore was gently slapping his own face, trying to come to grips with the notion.
"Let me get this straight. You're proposing that Roosevelt order the United States Navy to invade Greenwich Village and engage the Hudson Dusters?"
The doctor's mouth curled up gently again.
"Essentially, yes."
Marcus stepped in quickly.
"It may sound outlandish, John," he said, looking encouraged by the idea, "but it won't play that way in reports. If any violence should occur, it'll just read like a typical brawl between sailors and gangsters, and while it goes on, we'll be able to do what we need to."
Tucking his letter from Mr. Roosevelt into his jacket, the doctor dashed for the stairs.
"I'm going to telephone him in Washington straightway," he said, heading down toward the kitchen. "There's no time to be lost. The woman must even now be planning her flight from the city."
Suddenly there was a new feeling of life in the house, one brought on, I knew, by the bare possibility of even indirect involvement in the case on the part of Mr. Roosevelt. He had that effect on people, did the former police commissioner. Of all the doctor's close friends, there wasn't one with a purer love of life, of action, and most especially of a good fight, whether boxing or politics or war. But he was a kind man, too, was Mr. Roosevelt. As kind as anyone whatever came to the doctor's house in all the years I lived there. And I found that even I, in my saddened state, took a lot of heart from the thought that he might give us a hand in bringing Libby Hatch to justice. Oh, the idea was a crazy one. Mr. Moore was right about that much. But practically every undertaking Mr. Roosevelt got involved with seemed crazy at the start, yet most of them ended up being not only important but happy achievements. So as we waited for the doctor to return from the pantry, we began to talk over the details of the plan with an interest what bordered on enthusiasm. Enthusiasm, what was very surprising, considering all we'd been through. When the doctor came back upstairs, he was, if not out and out excited, at least very satisfied. "He'll do it. He wants us to wait here. He'll have someone from the Navy Yard inform us of what vessel will be available and when, but he promises action tonight." Mr. Moore let out another moan of disbelief, but even he was smiling a bit by that point. May God help us. So began more long hours of waiting. During the first couple of these, our quiet anticipation grew, fed by more of Cyrus's coffee, into a strange sort of hopeful fidgeting. But as the afternoon wore on, this feeling started to ebb, mostly because the telephone and the doorbell remained notably silent. Mr. Roosevelt was not a man to waste time, and the fact that we weren't getting word from any of his people in Brooklyn or anywhere else seemed what you might call mystifying. The rain didn't let up, and eventually its steady rhythm helped exhaustion take hold of each of us. Eager we might have been, but that didn't change the fact that nobody had really slept for more than an hour or so since Saturday night. One by one, members of our group began to drift off to bedrooms for cat naps, and each, including me, woke from these fitful spells of slumber to the disappointing news that there'd still been no message from either Washington or Brooklyn. Finally, as 5 o'clock drew near, the doctor went back downstairs to call Mr. Roosevelt again. And when he returned this time, his mood was very different from what it had been earlier. He hadn't gotten through to his friend, but he had come away from a conversation with Mr. Roosevelt's secretary with the distinct impression that the man was in his office and avoiding the doctor's call specifically. No one could make any sense out of this at all. Mr. Roosevelt was not a man to avoid a straight nose-to-nose jawing with anybody, especially someone he cared about and respected. If he'd found he couldn't deliver on his earlier pledge to the doctor, he would certainly have gotten on the telephone to say so. What, then, could be the explanation? Had he discovered the Spanish connection to the case of Libby Hatch somehow, and decided to pursue a separate course on his own? Such questions were not exactly the kind what would have revived our weakened enthusiasm, and by 7 o'clock the whole bunch of us were strewn around the doctor's parlor, dozing. The rain had finally lightened up, and I was lying in front of one of the open French windows on the carpeted floor, letting the cool air that the storm had brought into the city play over my face and lull me into the first really decent rest I'd had all day. Still, it was a light sleep, one easily interrupted by noises from outside, and the noise what I heard coming from that direction at about 7:30 was one what was at once so familiar yet so out of place that I honestly couldn't tell if I was asleep or awake. It was the forceful, high-pitched sound of Mr. Roosevelt's voice. "Wait here," it was saying, then I heard the sound of a carriage door closing. "I shall want you to take us to the yard as soon as we've had a chance to speak with the others." "Yes, sir," came a crisp, efficient answer, one what caused me to roll over and look outside. And there he was, all right. The Assistant Secretary of the Navy, done up in his best black linen and walking side by side with an older man who wore a Navy officer's uniform. "Holy Christ," I mumbled, rubbing my eyes to make sure I wasn't seeing things. "Holy Christ," I repeated, loud enough for the others to start coming out of their slumbers. Unable to stop myself from breaking into a smile, I scrambled to my feet and began shaking whatever shoulders I could grab fastest. "He's here! Doctor, Miss Howard, it's Mr. Roosevelt! He's here! Holy Christ!" At this news, the others got to their feet, looking just as confused and unsure of their senses as I'd felt, that is, until they heard the sound of the front door opening. "Doctor!" came the bark from downstairs. "Moore, where in thunder are you all?" Heavy footsteps pounded on the stairs as the shouting continued. "And where is the brilliant Sarah Howard, that former secretary of mine?" A few more heavy steps, and then those unmistakable features began to appear in the shadows at the top of the stairs, in a sort of reversed version of Mr. Lewis Carroll's Cheshire Cat. Mr. Roosevelt generally became visible grin first, his big teeth standing out in even the deepest blackness. Next to be seen were the small, squinting eyes behind the little steel-rimmed spectacles, and finally the square head, the broad mustache, and the huge barrel chest, the last of which had been built up after enduring a childhood of terrible asthma to become one of the most powerful in the world. "Well," he cried out as he moved down the hall, followed by the much calmer and very wise-looking Navy officer, "I like this. Crime and outrage running rampant, and you all lollygagging about as if there were no action to be gotten." He put his hands to his hips as he came into the parlor, still grinning from ear to ear. Then he shot his right paw out to the doctor. "Chrysler, delighted to see you. Doctor, delighted." "Hello, Roosevelt," the doctor answered with a smile. "I suppose I should have known you wouldn't miss this chance." "Hell," Mr. Moore said, "we all should have known." Making his way around the room, Mr. Roosevelt pressed the flesh hard with everybody and accepted a warm hug from Miss Howard. He was especially glad, it seemed to me, to find that the Isaacson brothers were there and still on the police force, for it was himself who'd brought them in as part of his effort to loosen the grip what the Irish clan of Tammany hirelings had on Mulberry Street. When he finally got around to saying hello to me, I'd gotten so excited by his presence and the new hope it seemed to bring that I was shifting from foot to foot nervously. Still, there must have been much of the morning sadness left in my face, for Mr. Roosevelt's smile shrank a little as he leaned down to shake my hand and look into my eyes.
"Well, young Stevie," he said with real sympathy, "you've had a hard time of all this, I understand. But don't doubt this, my boy."
He put one of his tough hands on my shoulder.
"We have come here to see that justice is done."
Chapter 54. As the Isaacsons began to sort through all their housebreaking equipment and weapons, figuring out what we'd need for our final assault on number 39 Bethune Street, the rest of us rushed to get into suitable clothes for the mission. You didn't often stand still, and you never wasted time when Mr. Roosevelt was around. Once we were reassembled in the parlor, the former police commissioner took a moment to introduce us to his companion. "Lieutenant William W. Kimball, of the United States Navy," Mr. Roosevelt said proudly, almost as if the officer was one of his own kids, instead of a man who obviously had a few years on him. Quite a few years, in fact. When it came my turn to shake hands with the officer, I wondered why, at his age, almost 50 it turned out, he was still stuck with such a low rank. It wasn't until later that somebody explained to me that his situation wasn't unusual. Being as the Navy hadn't seen any real action since the Civil War, advancement had gotten to be a very slow process. "Lieutenant Kimball lectures at the Naval War College," Mr. Roosevelt continued, "and has no equal when it comes to the business of war plans." "Why, Roosevelt," Mr. Moore mocked, "are you planning a war?" Mr. Roosevelt held up a finger. "Now, now, Moore, you won't snare me with any of your reporters' questions. The Navy is always developing contingency plans in the event of conflict with any power." "I shouldn't have thought that we required any strategic planning for what we are to undertake tonight," the doctor said, studying Lieutenant Kimball curiously. "Though you are, of course, welcome, Lieutenant."
"Thank you, Doctor," the lieutenant answered gamely. But even though he seemed to have some of the swagger, along with the usual large mustache of a sailor, you could tell from his voice that he also had far more brains than your garden-variety naval man. "It's not my war planning, though, that prompted Mr. Roosevelt to ask me along. I have some other areas of expertise that he thought might be useful."
"Indeed," Mr. Roosevelt agreed, pounding on the lieutenant's back. "Kimball here is a man ahead of his time. I hear nothing but battleships, battleships, battleships from most of our officers, but Kimball has put his mind to developing the weapons that will determine the course of naval warfare in the next century rather than the last. Torpedoes, submarines. I tell you, that French novelist Verne has nothing on the lieutenant here."
That comment snagged my interest, for the doctor had often given me books by Mr. Jules Verne to read, and the Frenchman's tales of life under the sea, trips to the moon, and powerful new weapons had kept me up late more than one night, wondering just what sort of a world we were actually heading for. "Is that true, Lieutenant?" I asked, as respectfully as I knew how. "Will we really fight underwater like Captain Nemo?" The lieutenant smiled and reached out to tousle my hair some.
"Oh, yes, Master Taggart, but without Nemo's electrical guns, I'm afraid, at least for the moment. The torpedo will be the submarine's principal armament, and together with torpedo boats, they will become the deadliest enemies of all ships."
"Torpedo boats?" I echoed. "What are those?"
"Those," Mr. Roosevelt answered, "are the reason that Lieutenant Kimball is here, Stevie. Small, lightly armored craft, capable of remarkable speeds. I cruised in one from Oyster Bay to Newport a few weeks ago, and I don't mind telling you all, it was bully. Like riding a high-mettled horse, agile, quick, capable of striking without warning and then disappearing."
He turned to the doctor.
"Just the sort of thing, it seemed to me, that your business tonight requires, Chrysler."
The doctor considered that idea. "Yes. Yes, the ability to arrive suddenly and depart at high speed will be a great asset. And where are these craft at the moment?" "We have several out at the Navy Yard," Lieutenant Kimball answered. "They require relatively small crews, but more men can be taken on if we feel we need them."
"The more the better if we're going up against the dusters," Mr. Moore said. "I don't suppose there's any chance these torpedoes can reach a few blocks inland, Lieutenant?"
"I'm afraid not, Mr. Moore," Lieutenant Kimball answered with a smile. "Once ashore, we'll have to rely on ourselves."
"Yes," Mr. Moore said, not very enthusiastically. "I was afraid of that." "Take heart, John," Mr. Roosevelt said, thumping his old friend on the back the way he had Lieutenant Kimball. Mr. Moore, though, didn't look too pleased by the action.
Why, we can put 60 sailors against those—
Teddy, Mr. Moore interrupted, using the childhood name what Mr. Roosevelt was known to dislike. It's going to be a hell of an evening, and if you start slapping me now, I won't be able to stand up by the time it's all over.
Ha! You don't fool me with that talk. I know the true measure of your abilities, Moore. I saw them amply displayed in our last adventure together.
Walking over to Miss Howard, Mr. Roosevelt took her hands in his warmly.
And you, Sarah. That dress may be plain, but I'll wager it has room enough for a certain pearl-handled Colt of yours.
Along with a considerable supply of cartridges, Miss Howard replied with a nod. So don't anyone think of jeopardizing themselves by keeping a special eye out for me.
As if we don't know that, Lucius said, shaking his head.
Ah, and my Maccabees, Mr. Roosevelt said, moving over to the Isaacsons. Kimball, you will never meet two men who combine bravery and brains more than the detective sergeants here. I was called a lot of things for bringing Jews onto the police force, but I stand by the decision. Why, if we had 6 or 7 men like these in naval intelligence, I dare say— Ah!
Realizing that he was about to say too much about his business in Washington, Mr. Roosevelt smiled and raised a hand.
But I'm straying from the affairs of the moment. Cyrus, he went on, approaching my big friend, what about you? Will you rely on those fists alone, or will you take along something a little more substantial?
Fists'll suit me fine, sir,
Cyrus answered with a smile. I owe a couple of those dusters a few good licks.
And you'll get them in, I don't doubt it for an instant. You know, we must go a few rounds in the ring some day, you and I.
Curling up his arms, Mr. Roosevelt took a few light jabs in Cyrus's direction.
It would be fine sport, don't you think?
I'm at your disposal, sir,
Cyrus replied, bowing a little and still smiling.
First rate, Mr. Roosevelt answered. That's bully. Well, now, we're expected at the yard. The crews have been alerted and are standing by. Everyone prepared? Good. I have a carriage waiting, Doctor, one that can accommodate most of us, and perhaps the rest can travel in one of yours.
I fear cabs will be necessary, the doctor answered, as we've had no time to retrieve our horses from the boarding stables.
Well, then, who's to ride with the lieutenant and myself? Mr. Roosevelt asked. What about you, Stevie? Like to hear more stories about the wondrous weapons Lieutenant Kimball dreams of loosing on the world?
I looked quickly and eagerly to the doctor, who nodded, knowing, I think, how much I did want to go with the Navy man and why. The discussion of weapons and destruction, far from thrilling me in any boyish way, was speaking to a dark, determined desire, one what had been planted by Cat's death and had been growing all day, the hope that we might finally be able to strike at Libby Hatch in a way what even she wouldn't be prepared for.
"Yes, sir," I told Mr. Roosevelt. "I'd like that."
"Good. Kimball, I appoint young Taggart your aide for this operation. Don't underestimate him. Several officers of this city's police force made that mistake, and some of them still can't walk correctly."
As Mr. Roosevelt turned to the doctor, his expression grew more serious. "I hope you'll ride with us too, doctor," he said. Then he looked to Miss Howard. "And you, Sarah, as well, for I confess I'd like to know more about this devilish woman we're chasing." With the thick gray layers of storm clouds, what had hung over the city that day now breaking up into separate black clusters that stood out boldly against the moonlit sky, we all filed out of the house and moved to the corner of 2nd Avenue, followed by Mr. Roosevelt's big landau, what had its 2 canopies pulled up against the weather. Once we'd secured 2 hansoms for Mr. Moore, the detective sergeants, and Cyrus, the rest of us got into the landau behind Mr. Roosevelt and Lieutenant Kimball, and before long conversation was filling the roomy shell under the canopies. The doctor, Miss Howard, and Mr. Roosevelt spoke about Libby Hatch and the case in quiet tones, what showed consideration for my feelings, consideration I appreciated greatly. As for the amiable Lieutenant Kimball, he seemed so determined to keep me entertained that I wondered if maybe Mr. Roosevelt, who obviously knew at least the basic facts of what I'd been through that day, hadn't given him instructions to try to give my spirits a lift. If so, the lieutenant followed his orders admirably. From a description of all the wondrous things what he expected to take place on the seas in the next 10 or 20 years, he moved on to tales of foreign lands he'd served in and of the strange people he'd met there, stories that, while they couldn't and didn't really cheer me up as such, at least diverted my attention from the bleak thoughts that were still standing ready to flood back into my soul. We took the Brooklyn Bridge across the lower portion of the East River, then made a hard left and traveled along the waterfront until we reached Wallabout Bay and the entrance to the great maze of dry docks, piers, cranes, railroad tracks, ordnance docks, foundries, and construction sheds, what was the Brooklyn Navy Yard. The place was pretty much a New York institution, dating back to the beginning of the century and as familiar to natives of the city as any part of the harbor. But for some reason it looked very different to me that night. Maybe it was just my mood, I thought to myself, or maybe it was visiting the place in the company of the man who, for all practical purposes, was the most important naval official in the country at that moment. But very soon I realized that neither of these was the real explanation. It was the lights. There were lights on everywhere, and underneath the lights, scores of men hard at work. All this at near 10 o'clock on a Monday night. And as I noticed the men, I noticed what it was that they were working on. Armored warships. Some of them half-built, some near ready to sail, all of them big and impressive, were crammed into every slip and corner of the joint. "An awful lot of building going on out here, Mr. Roosevelt," I said, watching fire tenders and riveters holler to each other and toss red-hot plugs of steel through the black night. "Yes," Mr. Roosevelt answered, looking around like a kid on Christmas morning. "We launched the Maine from here 2 years ago, and there have been several others since, many more to come as well." Out of the corner of my eye, I caught the doctor giving Miss Howard a look, a quiet reminder of how important it was that Mr. Roosevelt not find out just whose baby it was we were trying to rescue or why we'd been forced to go about it the way we had. The daughter of a high Spanish official missing, that same official beating his wife and not seeming to care if he never saw his child again, the lies about the case what had been issued by the Spanish consulate. Suddenly all these things seemed very connectable to the humming activity in the Navy Yard in a way what could have spelled bigger trouble than even we'd experienced lately. The torpedo boats, what Mr. Roosevelt and Lieutenant Kimball had spoken of, were tucked away along one concrete wharf at the far end of the yard, and quite a collection they were, too. Not all that much bigger than the steam yachts and launches, what generally shot around the harbor, the boats had much more powerful engines, what required 2 and even 3 smokestacks. At the same time, they were much sleeker in design than the private and commercial vessels, having a graceful bullet shape, what made it seem impossible that they were actually plated with steel. Not that there was much plating on them. As Mr. Roosevelt had said, the boats sacrificed safety for speed, and they could go better than 30 miles an hour when required. Each boat appeared to be manned by just 25 or 30 men, and at various spots on their decks they carried the deadly weapons what gave them their names, torpedoes, 14-foot steel cylinders filled with compressed air and tipped with powerful explosive devices. The air, when it was released, shot the missiles on their way out of the boat's torpedo tubes and through the water for upwards of hundreds of yards. Plenty of time for the fast little boats what delivered them to get clear of the resulting explosions. All in all, a very ingenious bit of inventing, one what stood in very great contrast to the enormous battleships with their huge artillery turrets what were being built in other parts of the yard. It would certainly be interesting to see, I thought to myself, if the battleships of other countries would one day be laid low by the same kind of fast, hard-hitting little craft as we were on our way to board that night. Along with the crews of the torpedo boats, there were another 20 or so sailors lined up on the wharf, men who looked like they'd been specifically selected for the job ahead of us. I'd seen a lot of brawling seamen in my day and in my neighborhood, and watched more than one dive and concert saloon get dismantled when a group of them were taken by some fast-talking dancer or quick-handed faro dealer, but no bunch I'd ever come across could have matched those boys what were waiting for us at the yard that night. Muscle-bound, scarred, and obviously itching for a genuine top-drawer brawl, the men appeared to be having a tough time controlling their high spirits enough to stand to attention when Lieutenant Kimball and Mr. Roosevelt got out of the landau. Lieutenant Kimball had some words with the 3 torpedo boat commanders, who then mustered their crews on the wharf next to the bruisers what were already there. Stepping in front of this collected force, which I had to admit looked to be a fair match even for the dusters, Lieutenant Kimball ordered them to stand at ease, then began to walk up and down the wharf as he explained the evening's business. "Gentlemen," he called out, his strong voice giving no hint of either his near 50 years or his usual assignment as a strategy planner.
Most of you, I'm sure, know that it is absolutely impossible to sail salt water in Uncle Sam's service for 30, 10, or even 5 years without becoming imbued with the feeling that the United States of America is the finest and most glorious thing that has ever happened, and that it must lead in everything. Here the men broke into cheers, cheers what Mr. Roosevelt heartily joined. The rest of us held back, feeling that it wasn't really our place to take part, though I felt an urge to. But, the lieutenant went on, I suspect you also know that the United States cannot lead in everything so long as enemies stand in its way. Enemies without, who will, with any luck, soon feel the power of the great ships being built around us, and enemies within, who must feel our power on this very night. That got the boys going again, and Lieutenant Kimball had to work hard to get them to quiet back down. I ask you now to give your attention to the Honorable Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Mr. Theodore Roosevelt. Stepping to the fore, Mr. Roosevelt narrowed his eyes and took the measure of the company before him. Men, he said, in that crisp, choppy way of his, some of you may find the job ahead of us a strange one. Why, you might reasonably ask yourselves, should we be assigned the task of enforcing the laws of this great nation on our own soil? Balling up one fist, Mr. Roosevelt began to smack it into his other palm as he continued to bellow over the sounds of the construction what was going on all around the yard. The answer, men, is a simple one. Because those persons to whom the safety of the public and the enforcement of justice in this part of our nation have been entrusted are failing to perform their duty. And who is it that the United States invariably calls on when its citizens are in danger anywhere in the world and no one else can or will assume the responsibility of protecting them? With a unity of voice, what was both very shocking, given the men, and very thrilling, given the situation, the sailors all roared out, "The United States Navy, sir!" The sound nearly knocked those of us behind Mr. Roosevelt over, but he only grinned and shook his fist in the air. "Indeed," he called out, "I expect you to fight fairly, men, but I expect you to fight hard. Thank you all." Then Mr. Roosevelt stepped aside to let Lieutenant Kimball speak again. Officers will carry sidearms. Petty officers and seamen will carry nightsticks. Force will be applied when force is encountered. This is a military police action, gentlemen. I know you will conduct yourselves accordingly. Now, fall out to board your boats. With another mighty roar, this one of pure excitement and lust for action, the men broke ranks and started for the torpedo boats, jumping into them as the engineers let off loud, hissing blasts of steam from the power plants of each vessel. Lieutenant Kimball directed our party to the lead boat, where we took up positions just behind the steering house. Orders to cast off were barked out over the rising grind of the steam pistons, and then, very suddenly it seemed, the boat's propellers began to churn up the waters of the bay, and we shot out toward the river at a speed I'd certainly never experienced on the water, and what made me stumble back a bit. As the air forced against our faces and bodies by the quickening pace of the boat became ever more powerful, Mr. Roosevelt put one of his strong arms around my shoulders and held me steady. Smiling up at him, I turned to watch the other two boats fall in behind us. I don't know that I've ever truly been able to describe the feeling what came over me at that moment, though I've tried many times. I was heartened past words by the sight of the two boats behind us and by the rumble of the powerful engines in our own vessel. All the emotions of the night and the day what had just passed, not to mention those of the tough and often frightening weeks what had come before, suddenly jumped out of my mouth in a loud holler, one what Mr. Roosevelt joined me in. Turning forward again, I caught sight of the same Brooklyn Bridge what we'd crossed just half an hour earlier, and which we were currently moving toward at a speed what was beginning to seem impossible. Viewing the bridge from below was so peculiar as to seem like a dream, especially given how fast we passed under it. Yet we were about to go faster still. As we motored past Hickey the Hun's best-loved swimming spot, the Fulton Fish Market, and on toward the base of Manhattan in Battery Park, the commander of our boat gave the signal to turn the engine fully loose, so that by the time Lady Liberty came into view it seemed that we could have reached her island in just a matter of seconds. Glancing over at the rest of our group, I could see that they too were impressed by the speed and maneuverability of the wondrous little craft we were riding in. The doctor, Mr. Moore, and the Isaacsons were all taking turns peppering Lieutenant Kimball with questions what were often hard to hear over the ever greater din of the boat's powerful engines.
As for me, I had no questions, only more emotions, ones as irresistible as the floating weapon we were traveling aboard. When we turned north to enter the waters of the Hudson, and I saw all those spots on the waterfront where I'd so often come to brood about Cat, I turned those feelings loose, letting tears of sadness, rage, and determination mix with those what were being drawn out of my eyes by the powerful rush of air what was slamming ever harder against our faces. "We've got you now, Libby Hatch," I began to whisper to myself through clenched teeth. "We've got you. We've got you." Chapter 55. Just as the doctor had figured, the gigantic two-story housing of the White Star Line pier provided us with the kind of cover an ordinary open wharf couldn't have. As the torpedo boats closed in on 10th Street, the commander of our vessel ordered our little fleet to slow up some, and then we cruised quietly in toward the waterfront, slipping alongside the long green shed of the pier and tying up on pilings near some ladders what led up from the water to a doorway into the structure, leaving behind about half of the crews to watch over the boats, but taking all the additional sailors what had been assigned to the job. We scrambled quickly up the rungs of those perilous approaches and then into the bottom floor of the pier, the baggage claim area, an enormous open space what was usually a madhouse of crazed activity. Empty as it was that night, it had a very ghostly feel to it, and for the first time my feeling that we were on an unstoppable mission began to mix with a healthy dose of anxiousness. The few guards and White Star officials what were in the place had, it seemed, been alerted to our coming as they cooperated with Mr. Roosevelt, whose face was all the identification he needed in New York City, just as it would soon be all over the United States and the world, by guiding us out to the front door without any questions at all. As we walked, the doctor pulled alongside me. "I have not," he said quietly, "brought up the subject of your sudden departure from Boston Spa, Stevie, given the events of the day. Nor shall I do so now. I ask only this. Please, stay close to someone larger or better armed than yourself at all times. It's not that I doubt your ability to defend yourself, but this woman—" "You don't have to tell me," I said, trying to reassure both him and myself as we moved out of the pier and into the darkness of the waterfront. "I got no ideas about going up against her alone, though I might like to." The doctor reached around to give me a quick embrace. "I know. But she is a creature of infinite resource. In fact, even with this force, I hope that we are adequately prepared." There were some gangs of longshoremen roaming the waterfront, but they knew better than to tangle with or mouth off to 50 or 60 armed sailors who looked as full of purpose as our men did. We decided to stick to West Street, what ran alongside the river, for the 5 blocks between the pier and Bethune Street, figuring that the dusters wouldn't be expecting anybody to enter their territory from that direction, and we'd be able to at least get close to Libby Hatch's place without being detected. We hadn't gone 2 blocks, though, before dark, mysterious shapes began to move around on the inland side of the wide street. They appeared in pairs at first, but those pairs quickly grew to become packs, the way mangy, tight-ribbed dogs'll do when they spot a possible source of food. It didn't seem like they had any idea of why we'd come, because before long the usual idiot taunts and challenges began to echo out across to us. It was just gang members pissing on their territory to let other animals know it was taken. I knew that. But I also knew that, given our mission, it could quickly turn into something much worse. By the time we'd reached 11th Street, the shadows across from us had grown to about 15 in number, and they were feeling bold enough to start throwing rocks and bottles over our way. Mr. Roosevelt and Lieutenant Kimball weren't standing for any such behavior, and they made as much clear pretty quick. As soon as the first missile landed, Mr. Roosevelt barked out, "Kimball!" The lieutenant responded by turning to one of his officers. "Lieutenant Commander Simmons, take 10 men, sir, and deal with those persons." Now, I didn't want to pipe up and tell those Navy boys their business, but it seemed to me that this might have been a wrong move, being as the dusters were not likely to be expecting such a response, and the forcefulness of it could very well tip them off to the fact that they weren't just watching a party of sailors on shore leave making their way uptown for a night of gambling and whoring. Still, there was no small satisfaction in watching one of the torpedo boat commanders and his detachment move at double time across the cobblestones of West Street, sidearm and nightsticks at the ready, and plow into the Bernie-crazed, confused dusters with such determination that what followed couldn't really have been classified as a fight. One or two of the gang members took nice shots across the head, and a couple more got good swift pokes in the gut. But the rest, alarmed by the sight of the lieutenant commander's pistol, just ran. Unfortunately, I knew only too well that they were running back to Hudson Street to fetch reinforcements and weapons and let Gugu Knox and Ding Dong know what was going on. "Here we go," I whispered to myself nervously as we crossed West Street at Bethune and the detachment what had sent the first group of dusters running rejoined us. All of a sudden, the block and a half to Libby Hatch's house was looking very long to me now that contact had been made, and when I saw Miss Howard and Lucius pull out their revolvers, I decided to move in behind them. Cyrus, meanwhile, slipped his right hand into his jacket pocket and got his brass knuckles on. Something ugly, we both knew, was most definitely coming. We saw a few more shadowy figures bolt out of doorways and alleys on the north side of Bethune Street, and also out of the construction site of the new Bell Telephone Laboratories on our side. The sailors with us seemed to take all this scurrying as a sign that the dusters had already gotten the message and weren't going to be any trouble. Unfortunately, we civilians knew better. Like most gangs, the dusters didn't favor any fight where they didn't enjoy an advantage in both numbers and weapons. And it was pretty obvious that they were just regrouping, probably for some kind of a stand at Washington Street. This collecting of forces would, I was sure, only take place after a considerable amount of Bernie blowing, which meant that when we faced the gang, they'd be wound up to the point where they figured they'd be a match for the entire U.S. Navy, let alone the few men what were now entering their territory. For several long minutes, though, Bethune Street in front of us remained quiet and empty. A fact what struck me as odd. And my nervousness began to let up a bit as I allowed myself the thought that maybe I was just being what you might call an alarmist. But of course, I wasn't. Just before we reached the intersection of Washington Street, they began to fan out in a thick line in front of us. More dusters, maybe 60 or 70 in all, than I'd ever seen gathered in any one spot in my life. Ding Dong had brought out most of the kid auxiliaries, and these young hellraisers were all making the same kinds of moves what we'd seen them get up to when we'd first come to Libby Hatch's place, slapping big slabs of wood into their palms, polishing up brass knuckles, and looking like it was all they could do to keep from rushing straight at us. To top it all off, every member of the gang's eyes were lit up like the windows at McCreary's department store on a Thursday night, showing that I hadn't been wrong in supposing they'd gotten themselves good and wound up before they moved out to meet us. Leading this very dangerous-looking mob were Gugu Knox and Ding Dong, who had, it seemed, patched up their squabble of earlier in the day, or more likely, they'd just put off one good scrape in favor of a better one. As usual, Ding Dong was grinning like an idiot, in that way what, to my everlasting confusion, Cat had found so charming. Knox, on the other hand, though the look on his face and the axe handle in his hand said that he was ready to go at it, was wearing an expression what also made it clear that he had a much better idea of who he was up against. This was understandable, for as leader of the Hudson Dusters, he'd crossed paths with Mr. Roosevelt during our friend's term as police commissioner many times, and he knew that if the burly swell with the spectacles showed up looking like he was ready for trouble, you could count on the fact that such wasn't a bluff. Knox was a scary-looking little package, wild-eyed and strong-armed, to be sure, but with skin so pale as to make him seem like a ghost. This was due partly to his heritage, but mostly to the fact that he almost never saw daylight. Before becoming one of the founders of the Dusters, he'd been a member of the Gophers, another frightening, unpredictable group of violent Irishmen who ruled in Hell's Kitchen and got their name from the fact that they spent their days in the cellars of that neighborhood drinking, carousing, and doing whatever else passed for living in their book. Only at night did they come outside to raid the train yards on the west side, lock horns with other gangs, or engage in their other favorite outdoor sport, beating cops unconscious and stealing their uniforms to give to their girlfriends as trophies. It was partly because so many dusters were former gophers that the newer gang was feared by the police department. Along with the practice of raiding the train yards on the west side, the dusters had maintained the gophers' taste for going after men in uniform. I didn't know whether that taste included the uniform of the U.S. Navy, but from the look on Knox's face that night, I figured we could be pretty sure that it did.
"Mr. Roosevelt," Gugu called as our party drew up close to the gang, "I heard you was in Washington playing with boats. What brings you to the duster territory?"
"When I last checked, Knox," Mr. Roosevelt answered, "the west side of New York City was still part of the United States. These are men of the United States Navy, and they are here to assist the detective sergeants," he pointed a thick finger at the Isaacsons, "in the performance of their duty."
"And what duty might that be?"
Knox asked, though it was easy to see that he knew the answer.
"What it might be is none of your business," Mr. Roosevelt answered. "You and your followers had better step aside."
"I don't think you get it," Knox answered, looking to his boys with a smile, then sniffling and running his tongue around his upper gums.
This was a sure sign that he'd been blowing a lot of Bernie. The drug, taken that way, had the effect of making the upper part of people's mouths go numb, so that they seemed to have to check and see that their parts were all there every few seconds.
"Like I said," he went on, "this is duster territory. Other gangs don't come in here. City cops don't come in here. Don't nobody come in here if they don't want to take a beating."
"Really?" Mr. Roosevelt said.
"Yeah,"
Knox answered with a confident nod.
"Really?"
"Well," Mr. Roosevelt declared, glaring at Knox, "I'm afraid there's one exception to that rule which you may have overlooked."
"Oh? And what might that be, you piece of—"
As he said these last words, Knox made a sudden sweeping move and tried to swing the axe handle on Mr. Roosevelt. A bad mistake. With a speed what was always surprising, given his size and thickness, Mr. Roosevelt snatched the stick of wood out of Knox's hands, making all of the duster's eyes go wide. Then, in another quick motion, Mr. Roosevelt gave Gugu a wicked smack across the side of the head with the weapon.
"That might be the United States federal government," Mr. Roosevelt bellowed as Knox fell to his knees, moaning like the injured animal he was.
The other dusters took a couple of steps forward, like they might charge, but they were still too confused to take definite action. I could tell, though, that said situation wasn't going to last very long. I pulled on the doctor's sleeve, nodding my head in the direction of the river and trying to tell him I knew a full-scale battle was about to break out and that while it was raging, we'd do best to get back down to West Street and come at Libby Hatch's house from another direction. He got the message, and as the sailors closed ranks and got ready to receive the coming attack, all of our group started to walk slowly backward, all that is, excepting Cyrus, who'd locked eyes with Ding Dong and wasn't going anywhere. Second by second, the air got more and more charged. Then Knox, his forehead bleeding, gathered his wits, looked up at his boys and shouted,
"Well, what the hell are you waiting for?"
At that, the storm finally broke. In a solid, screaming wall, the dusters rushed forward and the sailors did likewise. Both sides mixed it up so fast that the use of pistols by either group became pretty near an impossibility from the start. It'd be a contest of fists and sticks, that much was obvious. And it'd likely take up the whole block we were standing on. We had to get away fast. "Run," I told Mr. Moore, who nodded and, together with the detective sergeants, started to dash west. Miss Howard and the doctor, though, hung back waiting for Cyrus.
"Cyrus," the doctor commanded as Miss Howard covered our big friend with her colt, "come with us now."
But Cyrus was way beyond taking any orders. As soon as the brawl had erupted, he'd reached out to grab Ding Dong by the shirt, then literally lifted him off the ground and thrown him about 6 feet behind the line of our sailors, where he wouldn't be able to get any help from his pals. Hitting the ground hard, Ding Dong had dropped the stick he was carrying, and Cyrus quickly kicked it away. Then he pulled Ding Dong to his feet and said,
"No sticks, no knives, no guns, and I'm no 14-year-old girl either. Now, let's see how you do."
With that, he started to pummel the duster, who had to work hard to cover himself and get in a few shots of his own. Sighing once, the doctor turned to Miss Howard.
"We'll have to leave him, Sarah. There is a matter of accounts to be settled. He'll be all right, but we must go."
Nodding reluctantly, Miss Howard turned her body west, but kept her eyes on Cyrus, and it was a good thing she did. Being as just as we started to move away, two dusters managed to break out of the brawl further up the street and ran over to try to give Ding Dong a hand. They were both carrying metal bars wrapped in burlap, and Cyrus had his back to them. Once again, it looked like he might get blindsided by the gang. Miss Howard, though, smoothly spun back around toward the fight, then raised her Colt and, holding it steady with both hands, let off two rounds, their explosions echoing off the buildings and the cobblestones thunderously. When the smoke of the shots cleared, the two dusters with the metal bars were lying on the ground, each one clutching at a shattered kneecap. Miss Howard smiled, and seeing that Cyrus was now pretty well having his way with Ding Dong, turned to follow the rest of us. Catching me staring at her in amazement, she said only, "I told you, Stevie, there is nothing like a bullet in the leg to make men mind their manners." Then she pushed me along toward West Street. The howls of rage and pain from the brawl were now filling the whole neighborhood, and as the six of us ran around the corner to Bank Street, it began to sound like hell itself had opened up on Bethune Street. Even the longshoremen on the waterfront were keeping clear of the action, and the residents of the neighborhood stayed locked up very tight in their homes. We could hear bolts being thrown on doors as we passed by on our way to Greenwich Street. But the overall effect of the battle turned out to be a helpful one, for as we turned north again and approached Bethune Street, we didn't catch sight of a single duster. They'd all gone to join in the fun. This left us an open road to Libby Hatch's place from the east, and in just a few more seconds, we'd reached it. "I doubt," the doctor said breathlessly, "whether knocking will prove useful, Detective Sergeants." Marcus quickly produced his crowbar and wedged it into the jamb of the door just to the right of the knob. He and Lucius both laid hold of the thing and got ready to put their full weight and strength into heaving away at it. "When we pull," Marcus said, sweating as much as his brother by that point, "the rest of you try to push on the door itself. Sarah, I think you'd better keep your Colt at the ready." As Miss Howard stood back to obey this request, the doctor, Mr. Moore, and I gathered around to fit into whatever spots we could reach on the door. "Ready?" Marcus asked, and we all grunted replies in the affirmative. "All right, then. One, two." As he called out three, he pulled hard on the crowbar with Lucius, and the rest of us shoved. The frame of the old door began to crack and splinter almost right away, and a few more good blows and yanks destroyed the right side of the structure completely. With a kick, Marcus burst the door open, and then we all stepped to either side very fast so that Miss Howard could train her gun immediately on nothing. There was no sign of life in the little entryway to the house, and the steps against the right-hand wall led up into darkness, what showed a similar lack of human activity. Miss Howard led the way in, still keeping her Colt trained on the darkness, and then the rest of us followed, frightened, yes, but also starting to feel tremendous disappointment. "She can't," the doctor whispered. "She can't have slipped away again." Inching our way into the dark house, we began to spread out, Lucius producing his revolver and taking a couple of steps up the stairway. He would have gone farther, followed by Mr. Moore and Marcus, but then we heard the sudden sound of a door slamming in the sitting room. There was only one such structure in that area. I knew that from my last visit. "The basement door," I whispered. And then the three men on the stairs came back down. Again, on Marcus's count, we all burst into the sitting area, led by Miss Howard and Lucius. But the room was too dark to reveal much of anything at first, except the general outlines of the furniture nearest to us and the entrance to the kitchen hallway at the back, which was why the voice, when we heard it come out of the shadows, was all the more frightening. "It doesn't matter now," said Libby Hatch, very quietly. "You found your way into the house, but you'll never find what you came for." Lucius opened his mouth, seeming like he wanted to announce to the woman that she was under arrest, but the doctor touched his arm and spoke in a calm voice. "Listen to me, Elspeth Franklin. You need not face death." But Libby Hatch only spat and cursed. "Damn you all!" Then we saw the sudden movement of a shadow in the hallway going toward the kitchen. It was nothing more than the briefest blur, and was followed, much to our increasing confusion and frustration, by the sound of feet climbing upwards. "Stairs," the doctor said. "There are back stairs." "I sure as hell never saw him," I said. "She may have had a concealed passageway built," Marcus offered, "when she had Bates reconstruct the basement." "One which will no doubt prove as difficult to enter as the chamber below," the doctor agreed with an agitated nod. "Quickly, then. Marcus, you, Lucius, and Moore, get downstairs. See what you can do to break into the chamber. Sarah, you and Stevie, come with me." With the sounds of the brawl still echoing out on the street, we all exploded off in our assigned directions, the men heading down the basement steps, and Miss Howard and I following the doctor up the staircase, past the second floor and onto the third. There we found a steel ladder that led to a hatchway in the ceiling. Miss Howard led the way up it, and opening the thing, tried to quickly jump out onto the roof. We might have known better than to go chasing an enemy as clever as Libby in such an obvious way. Being the last one up, it was hard for me to see exactly what happened next, but the doctor later related it to me. Once she'd stuck her head out of the hatchway, Miss Howard got pistol-whipped hard. A blow had forced her to let go of her Colt, which fell back down to the floor at the base of the ladder and rendered her unconscious right away. With surprising strength, increased, to be sure, by the desperateness of her situation, our enemy hauled Miss Howard's body up and out of the hatchway, laid it out on the tar-covered roof, and then trained a pistol of her own on the doctor. "You, of all people, should know that I'll use this, Dr. Kreitzler," I heard Libby Hatch say. "Now get up here and move very slowly." As the doctor climbed on up, I saw that I had a moment where I'd be out of view, so I scrambled down and fetched Miss Howard's gun, shoving it into my pants and covering it with my shirt so as to make it look as if I was still unarmed. Then I hurried back up the ladder, hoping to make Libby think that I hadn't had time to make the play. It worked. Once the doctor was up on the roof, I saw Libby's golden eyes, wide and crazed by this point, move into the hatchway and fix on me. "You too, boy," she said, obviously not knowing I was now armed. "Get up here." I followed the order, making sure to keep my movements slow and easy enough so as not to shake the Colt loose. When I'd got clear of the hatchway, Libby slammed it closed, and pointing the gun first at the doctor and then at me, used her free hand to drag Miss Howard's body over on top of the hatch cover, a move what would make it tough for anybody to open the thing from below. Standing up straight, Libby kept moving her gun back and forth from me to the doctor, trying to decide what to do and looking more unbalanced and wild than I'd ever seen her. "Which one? Which one?" she mumbled. Then she grabbed the doctor's arm and stuck the pistol to his head. "Put your hands in the air. You do the same, boy, and then stay very still if you want to keep the doctor's great brain in one piece." Looking over to see that Miss Howard, though out cold, was still breathing regularly, I raised my hands halfway up. Any higher, and I would have revealed the Colt tucked into my pants. Believing that both the doctor and I were going to do what she told us, Libby seemed to relax a little. She used one hand to straighten first her hair and then her dress, which I noted was the same red with black lace job what we'd first seen her in. At that point, her look of craziness gave way to something what might have almost passed for regret. "Why?" she asked, looking at the doctor.
"I should have thought that would be obvious," he answered, keeping his hands up.
Before Libby could answer, a particularly loud round of hollering and screaming came rising up from the street, and she turned toward it. "Do you hear that?" she said. "That's your fault. All of yours. None of this had to happen."
"If we'd left you free to continue murdering children, you mean?" the doctor asked.
"Murdering them?" Libby answered, now looking positively injured. "All I did, all I ever tried to do, was help them."
The doctor gave her a sideways glance. "I believe you mean that in some way, Elspeth Franklin," he said quietly. She nodded once, her golden eyes filling with tears. Then she stamped a foot suddenly and angrily.
"If you believe that, then why have you been hounding me like this?"
"Listen to me, Elspeth," the doctor went on. "If you surrender yourself, there may be a way to help you."
Libby's voice grew cold and mean. "Of course, in the electrical chair, you lying bastard."
"No," the doctor insisted, still quietly. "I can help you. I can try to make the authorities understand why you've done these things."
"But I've done nothing," Libby hollered, full of new desperation. "Can't you see that?" She paused, studying the doctor's face. No, of course you can't. You're a man. What man could understand what my life has been like? Why I've had to make the choices I have? Do you think I wanted any of this? It wasn't my fault that it happened."
I figured the only way I was going to be able to make a move for the Colt was to try to get the woman even more upset and off balance than she already was. So, though I knew the doctor wouldn't have approved, I began to taunt her.
"Yeah? What about the kid you buried with the dog? Whose fault was that?"
"You be quiet," she seethed, turning to me. "You're not even a man, just a boy. All you understand are your own damned needs, your own damned wants."
A woman probably worked herself raw raising you, and how did you ever repay her, except by spitting in her face, by disobeying, by whining, by—" Tightening her grip on her pistol, Libby glared at me harder than ever with those gold eyes. "You want to know about the boy in the grave, do you? I didn't ask for him, and I didn't want him. I had a beau, a respectable boy from a family that had a place in our world, the kind of boy I could have brought home to my mother to show that I could—" Her voice starting to wander, Libby glanced down at the tarred roof for an instant. "He would have done anything for me, and I did do anything for him, but then his family found out, and they wouldn't—" Quickly she looked back up. "And I was left with his lying, dirty seed in me. It wasn't wrong to prevent the disgrace. What could it have been but a bastard? Something else, something more that I'd done wrong. So I did what was right, but I couldn't even tell anyone.